Hello and welcome to the Plow and Stars podcast. In light of the recent terrorist attack by the United States government in Iraq against Iran, this is Red Bernard with a very short bonus episode to read an important piece from Lenin, The Defeat of One's Own Government in the Imperialist War, published in 1915. Obviously, our material circumstances are vastly different from those at the start of the First World War. However, it's important to keep in mind that Social Democrats will betray the class struggle in support of imperialist war. We must never back down from pointing out their failings in this regard. Here is The Defeat of One's Own Government in the Imperialist War. During a reactionary war, a revolutionary class cannot but desire the defeat of its government. This is axiomatic and disputed only by conscious partisans or helpless satellites of the social chauvinists. Among the former, for instance, is Semkovsky of the organizing committee, and among the latter, Trotsky and Buchvoyed, and Kautsky in Germany. To desire Russia's defeat, Trotsky writes, it is an uncalled-for and absolutely unjustifiable concession to the political methodology of social patriotism, which would replace the revolutionary struggle against the war and the conditions causing it with an orientation highly arbitrary in the present conditions towards the lesser evil. This is an instance of high-flown phraseology with which Trotsky always justifies opportunism. A revolutionary struggle against the war is merely an empty and meaningless exclamation, something at which the heroes of the Second International excel, unless it means revolutionary action against one's own government, even in wartime. One has only to do some thinking in order to understand this. Wartime revolutionary action against one's own government indubitably means not only desiring its defeat, but really facilitating such defeat. Discerning reader, note that this does not mean blowing up bridges, organizing unsuccessful strikes in the war industries, and in general helping the government defeat the revolutionaries. The phrase bandying Trotsky has completely lost his bearings on a simple issue. It seems to him that to desire Russia's defeat means desiring the victory of Germany. Buchvoyed and Semkovsky give more direct expression to the thought, or rather want of thought, which they share with Trotsky. But Trotsky regards this as the methodology of social patriotism. To help people that are unable to think for themselves, the Berne Resolution made it clear that in all imperialist countries, the proletariat must now desire the defeat of its own government. Buchvoyed and Trotsky prefer to avoid this truth, while Semkovsky, an opportunist who is more useful to the working class than all the others, thanks to his naively frank reiteration of bourgeois wisdom, blurted out the following: this is nonsense because either Germany or Russia can win. Take the example of the Paris Commune. France was defeated by Germany, but the workers were defeated by Bismarck and theirs. Had Buchvoyed and Trotsky done a little thinking, they would have realized that they have adopted the viewpoint on the war held by governments and the bourgeoisie, i.e., that they cringe to the political methodology of social patriotism, to use Trotsky's pretentious language. A revolution in wartime means civil war, the conversion of a war between governments into a civil war is on the one hand facilitated by military reverses, defeats, of governments. On the other hand, one cannot actually strive for such a conversion without thereby facilitating defeat. The reason why the chauvinists, including the organizing committee and the Jakedze group, repudiate the slogan is that this slogan alone implies a consistent call for revolutionary action against one's own government in wartime. Without such action, millions of ultra-revolutionary phrases, such as a war against the war and the conditions, etc., are not worth a brass farthing. Anyone who would in all earnest refute the slogan of defeat for one's own government in the imperialist war should prove one of three things. One, that the war of 1914 and 15 is not reactionary, or two, that a revolution stemming from that war is impossible, or three, that coordination and mutual aid are possible between revolutionary movements in all belligerent countries. The third point is particularly important to Russia, a most backwards country, where an immediate socialist revolution is impossible. That is why the Russian Social Democrats had to be the first to advance the theory and practice of the defeat slogan. The Tsarist government was perfectly right in asserting that the agitation conducted by the Russian Social Democratic Labor Group in the Duma, the sole instance in the international not only of parliamentary opposition but of genuine revolutionary anti-government agitation among the masses, that this agitation has weakened Russia's military might and is likely to lead to its defeat. This is a fact to which it is foolish to close one's eyes. The opponents of the defeat slogan are simply afraid of themselves when they refuse to recognize that the very obvious fact of the inseparable link between revolutionary agitation against the government and helping bring about its defeat. Are coordination and mutual aid possible between the Russian movement, which is revolutionary in the bourgeois democratic sense, and the socialist movement in the West? No socialist who has publicly spoken on the matter during the last decade has doubted this. The movement among the Austrian proletariat after October 17, 1905, actually proving it possible. Ask any social democrat who calls himself an internationalist whether or not he approves of an understanding between the social democrats of the various belligerent countries on joint revolutionary action against all belligerent governments. Many of them will reply that it is impossible, as Kautsky has done, thereby fully proving his social chauvinism. This, on the one hand, is a deliberate and vicious lie, which clashes with the generally known facts of the Basel Manifesto. On the other hand, if it were true, the opportunists would be quite right in many respects. Many will voice their approval of such an understanding. To this we shall say, if this approval is not hypocritical, it is ridiculous to think that in wartime and for the conduct of a war, some formal understanding is necessary, such as the election of representatives, the arrangement of a meeting, the signing of an agreement, and the choice of the day and hour. Only the Semkovskis are capable of thinking so. An understanding on revolutionary action in every single country, to say nothing of a number of countries, can be achieved only by the force of example of serious revolutionary action, by launching such action and developing it. However, such action cannot be launched without desiring the defeat of the government and without contributing to such defeat. The conversion of an imperialist war into a civil war cannot be made any more than a revolution can be made. It develops out of a number of diverse phenomena, aspects, features, characteristics, and consequences of the imperialist war. That development is impossible without a series of military reverses and defeats of governments that receive blows from their own oppressed classes. To repudiate the defeat slogan means allowing one's revolutionary ardor to degenerate into an empty phrase or sheer hypocrisy. What is the substitute proposed for the defeat slogan? Is it that of neither victory nor defeat? This, however, is nothing but a paraphrase of the Defense of the Fatherland slogan. It means shifting the issue to the level of a war between governments, who, according to the content of this slogan, are to keep their old stand, retain their positions, and not to the level of the struggle of oppressed classes against their governments. It means justifying the chauvinism of all the imperialist nations, whose bourgeoisie are always ready to say and do say to the people that they are only fighting against defeat. The significance of our August 4th vote was that we are not for war but against defeat. David, a leader of the opportunists, writes in his book, "The organizing committee, together with Buquet and Trotsky, stand on fully the same ground as David when they defend the neither victory nor defeat slogan. On closer examination, this slogan will be found to mean a class truce, the renunciation of the class struggle by the oppressed classes in all belligerent countries, since the class struggle is impossible without dealing blows at one's own bourgeoisie, one's own government, whereas dealing a blow at one's own government in wartime is, for Buquet's information, high treason. It means contributing to the defeat of one's own country. Those who accept the neither victory nor defeat slogan can only be hypocritically in favor of the class struggle, of disrupting the class truce. In practice, such people are renouncing an independent proletarian policy because they subordinate the proletariat of all belligerent countries to the absolutely bourgeois task of safeguarding the imperialist governments against defeat. The only policy of actual, not verbal, disruption of the class truce, of acceptance of the class struggle, is for the proletariat to take advantage of the difficulties experienced by its government and its bourgeoisie in order to overthrow them. This, however, cannot be achieved or striven for without desiring the defeat of one's own government and without contributing to that defeat. When, before the war, the Italian Social Democrats raised the question of a mass strike, the bourgeoisie replied, no doubt correctly from their own point of view, that this would be high treason, that Social Democrats would be dealt with as traitors. This is true, just as it is true that the fraternization in the trenches is high treason. Those who write against high treason, as Boukvoyev does, or against the disintegration of Russia, as Semkovsky does, are adopting the bourgeois, not the proletarian, point of view. A proletarian cannot deal a class blow at his government, or hold out, in fact, a hand to his brother, the proletarian of the foreign country, which is at war with our side, without committing high treason, without contributing to the defeat, to the disintegration of his own imperialist great power. Whoever is in favor of the slogan, neither victory nor defeat, is consciously or unconsciously a chauvinist. At best, he is a conciliatory petty bourgeois, but in any case, he is an enemy to the proletarian policy, a partisan of the existing governments, of the present-day ruling classes. Let us look at the question from yet another angle. The war cannot but evoke among the masses the most turbulent sentiments, which upset the usual sluggish state of mass mentality. Revolutionary tactics are impossible if they are not adjusted to these new turbulent sentiments. What are the main currents of these turbulent sentiments? They are, first, horror and despair, hence a growth of religious feeling. Again, the churches are crowded. The reactionaries joyfully declare, wherever there is suffering, there is religion, as said by the arch-reactionary Barr. He's right, too. Second, hatred of the enemy, a sentiment that is carefully fostered by the bourgeoisie, not so much by the priests. Arid is of economic and political value only to the bourgeoisie. Third, hatred of one's own government and one's own bourgeoisie, the sentiment of all class-conscious workers who understand, on the one hand, that war is a continuation of the politics of imperialism, which they counter by a continuation of their hatred of their class enemy, and, on the other hand, a war against war is a banal phrase unless it means a revolution against their own government. Hatred of one's own government and one's own bourgeoisie cannot be aroused unless their defeat is desired. One cannot be a sincere opponent of a civil, i.e. class, truce, without arousing hatred of one's own government and bourgeoisie. Those who stand for the neither victory nor defeat slogan are in fact on the side of the bourgeoisie and the opportunists, for they do not believe in the possibility of an international revolutionary action by the working class against their own governments. They do not wish to help develop such action, which, though undoubtedly difficult, is the only task worthy of a proletarian, the only socialist task. It is the proletariat in the most backward of the belligerent great powers, which, through the medium of their party, have had to adopt, especially in view of the shameful treachery of the German and French Social Democrats, revolutionary tactics that are quite unfeasible unless they contribute to the defeat of their own government, but which alone lead to a European revolution, to the permanent peace of socialism, to the liberation of humanity from the horrors, misery, savagery and brutality now prevailing.
Haben die Proleten Schluss gesagt und die Bauern, es ist soweit. Und haben den Kerensky davon gejagt und die Vergangenheit. Und das war im Oktober, als das so war. In Petrograd, in Russland, im 17er Jahr.
Da hat der Soldat das Gewehr umgewandt, da wurde er wieder Prolet, worauf sehr schnell vom Krieg abstand die Generalität.
Und das war im Oktober, als das so war, in Petrograd, in Russland, im 17er Jahr.
Da hatte der Muschik den Bauch nicht voll und da las er dann ein Dekret, dass dir das Korn jetzt fräst. essen soll, der auch das Korn abmäht.
Und das war im Oktober, als das so war, in Petrograd, in Russland, im 17er-Jahr.
Die Herren haben durchs Monokel geguckt und haben die Welt regiert. Und eh ein Matrose in die Neva spuckt, waren sie expropriiert.
Und das war im Oktober, als das so war, in Petrograd, in Russland, im 17er-Jahr. Und wer dies Lied euch singen tat, lebt in einer neuen Welt. Der Kumpel, der Muschik, der rote Soldat, haben die euch hingestellt. Und das war im Oktober, als das so war, in Petrograd, in Russland, im 17er-Jahr.